Welcome to EB5 Investment Voice, where attorney insights intersects with immigration investments. If you are a foreign investor, domestic fund manager, or enterprising entrepreneur and want to get the most out of the EB5 program, you have come to the right place. I'm Mark Deal, and I'll be your co-host on this journey. I'm joined by your host, Mona Shaw, and other attorneys at Mona Shaw & Associates, as well as immigration leaders from around the world. So let's get into EB5 Investment Voice. Mona, with all the EB5 changes that are coming about, there's also a lot of changes with the targeted employment areas and what counts and taking it away from the states and giving it to the federal agencies, and all the rules are changing. And I think it's about time we sit down with an economist.
That's right, Mark. For developers and investors, many of them are now looking beyond November 21, which isn't that far away, I can add, because the new regulations not only raise the minimum investment amount from $500,000 to $900,000 in a target employment area, but from $1 million to $1.8 million in a non-TEA, the definition between a TEA and a non-TEA has become really crucial. And the new regulations also revise the standards for certain targeted employment area designations. There's a lot to talk about. And I know there are a lot of people out there who really want to understand whether or not their project still qualifies as a TEA. So the best person for that is, and you know who.
I do. And our listeners may recognize his voice. We have back to the podcast, Jeff Carr. In fact, this is Jeff's third time visiting the show. He joined us the first time back in 2016. And I believe he's our first guest that's a three-peat. So, Jeff, welcome to the show. And I toss my hat for the hat trick.
Well, I hope that this isn't an indication of the lack of interesting topics to bring an economist in for.
No, did we even start saying that economists and TEAs and all this stuff was boring? Did I say that word?
No. Mona usually reserves that word when we start talking about the SEC. But I will say, behind the microphone, off the air, Mona and I have had some chatter back and forth on what this really means for a TEA. I thought one thing, and smarter people thought other things, and Jeff, you are obviously the expert, so you're here to set us straight and everyone else.
Jeff, before we jump into what everybody wants to know, what are you seeing right now? Are you doing a mad rush for last minute projects?
Yeah, probably. It's not as bad as it was back in 2015, but yeah, certainly people are concerned about the change in the minimum investment amount and change in TEA status, and particularly projects that are already in the marketplace and had already raised some funds. They're getting a little worried that they might not be able to sell out by the 21st of November when whatever is going to be there, whether it's the DHS regs or whether the industry is able to pull something together on the legislative front to trump those, no pun intended. Yeah. There's some concern about what's going to happen to projects and mid-capital raise.
Right. So this is basically what is going on in the market at the moment, because I think the industry has cried wolf so many times that, unfortunately, when the regulations came out, believe it or not, people still didn't believe that the amount was going to actually go up. And they were sitting on it, oh, we're going to get another extension, it's going to stay at 500. And now it's starting to sink in. And guess what? They can't pull the capital. So we are seeing this from so many investors. And yeah, I don't think every project will get filled up. I know we've heard the contrary, Mark, from people like Sam Udani, but I don't think Sam is seeing all that we are seeing.
You could be right.
So Jeff, before I even get into the question that so many people are asking about whether or not the new designation actually means that there's going to be no more projects in the urban sector, what about the current projects that we have? Are we able to take those projects and redesignate them and, you know?
Well, obviously, the whole intent of the regulations and the whole intent of any legislative prescription that might be passed to kind of nudge the DHS regulation out of effectiveness looks at making TEAs more restrictive so that we don't have a situation where we have, you know, spaghetti diagrams and things like that that are related to TEAs. Although, you know, there was some reasons for some of those spaghetti TEAs, and we talked about those, I think, a little bit earlier. But I think everyone's concerned by a couple things that seem to be the trend and where EB5 is going. Number one, the goal of the regulations and any reform is to make TEAs more prescriptive and limit the use of TEAs to be the exception rather than the rule in the program.
Now, to give some historical perspective for the person listening, what Jeff Carr was talking about before, the spaghetti diagrams, or what Mona sometimes calls the snake and the donut, which I think both are visually representative of what was happening with target employment areas in the past. And check out our earlier episode. It's about 3.5 years old. It was episode 7. But Jeff goes into great detail about targeted employment areas and how the census tracts could be merged to essentially account for people that live in one area and do work in another. And the thought behind that is that they spend money where they live, not necessarily where they work. And that's why a lot of these tracts were somewhat merged together. Now that we have that historical perspective, let's look towards the future.
Jeff, I know that you are quite savvy when it comes to being on top of what's going on in the EB5 world and the new proposed legislation. And as you know, all the stakeholders did get together, all these EB5 stakeholders, and we are really unified. We are unified as far as moving forward in the kind of legislation we want to see. And the agreement that we reached, the differential was only 100,000. However, the regs and anything which is coming out of Grassley's office is always 50% being the differential, not only 100,000. Do you know anything different?
No, and that's always something that's been subject to discussion. And the concern, I think, really is that if you're in a world now where 98% of the projects have investor amounts minimums that are at 500,000, the concern is that if you move in the direction with the legislation or with the DHS regs that are, now going to go into effect on November 21st, you go from 500,000 to 1.8 million. There's a lot of concern that we really don't know how much that's going to affect the ability of investors to be able to participate, because you're more than doubling what is going to be the effective minimum investor amount, whether you go through the regulations approach, or even if it goes to 800 and 900, which some of the legislative proposals do, you're still going to go from 500 to 900. And that's a lot.
Yeah, well, 5 to 9 is a lot. 5 to 1.8 is kind of
over 3x, yeah.
Yeah, that right. But what we have seen and what we've actually discussed is that a fact that I don't feel that USCIS really understands that people, they can go and visit urban projects. They can actually feel and smell and touch them in a way they don't feel close to rural projects.
Well, the implicit objective of at least some of the folks that were working on the regulations and some of the legislative offices as they were being developed was that, the projects in urban areas really don't need the EB5 money. And so if we make it difficult for those projects in the urban areas to access that EB5 money, that the money that would ordinarily flow into urban projects will automatically flow into the rural areas. And that could be true to some extent, but I do not believe it's a one-for-one displacement. And I don't think a lot of the legislative proposals or the regulatory proposals as they were being developed really understands what's going on in the marketplace from the standpoint of how the dollar amounts change and the minimum investments are going to affect overall deal flow. Because particularly as the economy is getting stronger, more traditional avenues of financing are opening up, which makes the EB5 approach less attractive, in part because of all the things that you have to do in order to plan for, qualify, monitor, and administer projects as they go over a great number of years.
I completely agree with you. So getting back to our snake and our donut, our current projects, what are you doing right now? Are you actually putting anything together for clients who want to know whether their projects really do still qualify?
Well, actually, dating back to the time that the regulations were first proposed in the waning weeks of the Obama administration, almost everybody, when they come to us and ask about TEAs, want to know, okay, how will the project fare under current rules, which is what everybody wants to know by default. Then right. Secondly, an awful lot of folks asked us, almost 90% of the project says, well, how do they qualify versus the current draft of the DHS regs, which, of course, changed a little bit between what they originally proposed back in December of 17 versus what they published a couple of months ago in advance of implementing them or thinking they're going to implement them on November 21st. And then an awful lot of folks also asked us what you see out there in the way of the legislative reform proposals that might be passed on or before November 21st, which might replace any DHS regulations that were set to go into effect. What do you see out there in terms of qualifying for a TEA in a metro area under the high unemployment rate tag? And so normally we look at opportunity zones, which seems to be it's an artifact of the current administration, and it seems to be the thing that seems to be underpinning most of the legislative reform proposals. So we've done three TEA assessments: current law, DHS regs, current legislative proposals. And almost all projects have done that in recent times.
Do you see, Jeff, one of the real problems of the regs being the fact that state designation is no longer there, that it's going to be USCIS?
Well, I don't know whether to call it a problem as much as it's a pretty significant change that I don't think everybody's really thought through at this particular juncture. I mean, going from the states to having the USCIS case officer adjudicated as, by all indications from the stakeholder conversations that we've had with the USCIS, it looks like they're going to treat this as just another item to be adjudicated at petition filing or exemplar filing. And I'm concerned that we haven't thought through all the mechanics of doing that. Number one, it means that the projects of the regional centers are going to have to take more of the burden for doing the actual technical calculations for high unemployment rate TEAs in metro areas.
Right.
And that means they have to develop the expertise or go out and acquire it by hiring an economist who knows what they're doing. And secondly, I can see some gray area still in what the definition of contiguous census tracts in, you know, is one where there's only a corner touching versus a pretty significant amount of border touching.
Jeff, before we go into that issue, because I really want to ask you about that, with regards to going out and putting the burden on the RCs and projects, USCIS stated in their response in the regs that they claim it's easy to check because it's all publicly available data.
Well, there's several data sets you can use, and one person's definition of contiguous may not be another person's definition of contiguous. And the only definition of contiguous that's going to matter is the USCIS case officer. And we've already spread them thin on the number of subjects they have to understand to now include all the technical aspects of local area labor market information, how it relates to submunicipal areas like census tracts. What if we want to go to census block groups? Are they going to understand that too? What's the most recent data for employment and unemployment that's available? There are several different data sources, the American Community Survey, local area unemployment statistics. And is the data available when the feds make it available or when the states distribute it to the census tracts? Nobody's really thought through those kinds of things.
No, I agree. But is it more fairer that USCIS really determined this rather than states? Because they did feel that states were prejudicial to themselves.
Well, you know, states can be prejudicial because they want to find a way to get to yes to support the economic development in their states. And maybe a USCIS case officer might not have that same kind of approach to things. And so the other thing I think that's important, and I don't think we fully vetted or thought through, is, you know, a lot of projects want to know whether they're in a TEA, whether they qualify for the lower minimum investment amount before they do things like go out and pursue their capital stack. And, you know, in business plans nowadays, you have to have a high degree of capital stack planning before you can get to the point where you can put together a Matterhoe-compliant project business plan. And a lot of project proposers or managers may not want to go through all of the expense of putting together investor documentation if they have a TEA determination in a metro area for a high unemployment rate TEA that may not be completely clear. And that's a thing I think that we haven't really thought through yet. And I don't see any evidence, for example, that the USCIS thinks that they need to put anything in the way of a pre-certification or a pre-documentation development opinion from them that says, yeah, it looks like it's okay to us, but we won't give you the formal certification until you actually file. Some states do that, and that's been helpful to some projects to put together the documentation. But in a situation where it's in the gray area and you can't get a pre-certification of a TEA, I can see a lot of projects that might not pursue EB-5 financing.
Well, actually, they do state in the regs, it does state that they do seek, if anybody wants to seek the optional exemplar approval of a project, then you can have a predetermination. The problem is, how long will it take to get an exemplar? Currently, it takes about 3 years. It's ridiculous. if they can expedite and you can actually get the exemplar approvals done quickly, maybe that will help. But I'd understand there really isn't going to be a separate process for specifically for specially designated TEAs.
That's what I was referring to. And right. I'm concerned that that may not be consistent with the project capital stack planning that's met, that's needed to put together an exemplar filing or an investor petition filing to even get into the queue to be reviewed. And I think, you know, in the defense of the USCIS, they truly do believe that this is going to change the high unemployment rate TEA designations from being 98% of the project to 10 to 15%. So they're not thinking that this is going to be a large administrative burden. But I think there are multiple levels of dynamics or how these projects are assembled and how the project documentation is developed that hasn't been fully considered yet. And we'll probably only do that after these things take effect, whichever bag of tricks actually happens.
Yeah, interestingly, one commentator, which was marked out in the Federal Register, did mention or did state that he believed that there would be challenges in the federal court. And DHS's response was, DHS disagrees with the commentator's interpretation of the case law, but in any case has elected to move forward with this proposal for the reasons expressed elsewhere within this preamble. And not really answering the issue at all. So really putting out the fact that, yeah, go sue us. It's not going to make any difference.
Well, there's going to be growing pains, as you know, and there's going to be a transition period, you know, not the least of which is if you can't get a decision from the USCIS on whether it's a TEA, what level of documentation and support are you going to need and from what sources are you going to need to be able to proceed to go to the marketplace to raise money while a determination on whether it's a TEA and qualifies for the lower minimum investment amount is still going to be pending.
That's true. And another interesting point, which was out on the Federal Register, was that DHS did state that, quote, if necessary, DHS could raise associated fees to bring on board additional adjudicators. So do you feel that that might be the area? They might be looking for economists just to come on board for this?
Well, you know, and I think anything's possible. I think the more technical expertise that the USCIS brings in, particularly if they're labor market specialists, just really understand the ins and outs of these types of calculations, would certainly be helpful. I do have a certain level of anxiety because that's been a reply to other areas of concern about adjudication loads for the DHS that have been expressed before that have gotten the same response and not the same result that was intended in the response.
And it didn't work. Last time they, I think, doubled the amount of EB-5 adjudicators. The time to review cases actually went up. And when asked about it, they said, well, we're training everybody and everyone's figuring out how to work together. So to Jeff's point, you know, you bring on some labor specialists that understand the economic analysis, but then how to work and integrate with everybody else to adjudicate these cases, yeah, it's not going to solve the problem in the short term.
And I don't even think that the project developers truly understand the significance of this change from the standpoint of what their burden is going to be to submit the evidence that's needed in order to get these high unemployment rate TEA determinations in their metro area projects.
Could you help us understand what that would be, Jeff?
Well, I don't think that they understand the different data sets and the different timing of what makes the data the latest year available or the latest period available part of the requirements for establishing a TEA. And that's because developers in the past, particularly for, you know, some states where a lot of activity is, like in New York, all you have to do is send them an address and they do the calculations for you to try to make a TEA work. In this world, the applicant themselves or the petitioner themselves is going to have to file the evidence. And so therefore, the projects are going to have to go out and develop that evidence. And I don't think that they've thought through all the technical aspects of that as well as I think I would like to see.
Jeff, I interrupted you earlier when you were relating to the contiguous census tracts issue. That's an area that we have discussed that is problematic, correct?
In some cases, it's going to be a lot more straightforward. You know, for example, if you're in a census tract where the census tract qualifies all by itself, there's not much gray area there. That's pretty black and white. You know, if it's one or two additional census tract where there's a lot of shared border on the borders of the census tract for all the census tracts that are brought into the TEA calculation, I think that's going to be pretty clear cut. I think that there are a number of projects that could result in like corners or points of census tracts being quote unquote touching the project where the project is located in that census tract. And so the question becomes, what is contiguous in the eyes of the project, is that going to also be contiguous in the eyes of the USCIS case officer? And I think that that's a matter of some gray area. And I think that that could be problematic for projects where they fall into the gray area of what defines contiguous. I mean, the industry maybe could have some input and impact into the actual practices of the USCIS case officers by making clear statements about what we expect, to the extent that that can be helpful and impactful to the adjudications after they start with the change rules. But I think that's still very much up in the air. And I think it runs the risk that otherwise, you know, really good projects that could qualify for the program may not go forward if there's a level of risk associated with the TEA certification calculation and evidence that may not be as clear cut as we'd like it to be.
So if just to explain this a little more for our listeners, Jeff, if we go back to our, you know, our usual sort of analogy of the snake and the donut. So we're talking about a donut here for the contiguous census tracts. So what you're saying is, so instead of a clear round donut, we might have a misshapen donut, which has a little bit of a corner, a little triangle at the end. And whether or not that triangle is acceptable, is that the issue?
Well, the donut is more square than it is round because census tracts tend to have straight lines and angles and things like that. And it's not unusual in a project to have a high unemployment rate census tract that would only come and touch the census tract where the project is located at a very tip of a point and not have much of a border, you know, like not have a long line of contact, you know, along, for example, a triangle or something like that, where the whole side of the census tract touches the census tract where the project is located. And so there could be some gray area there, and that may constitute enough risk to make project developers say, nah, we're not going to do this. And it would otherwise have been a great project. It's just that they won't want to go into the marketplace without an advantage, given the other capital sources that they may have access to that could, you know, potentially be a replacement for EB-5.
We had Sam Odani on the show a couple of weeks ago, and he dismissed urban projects moving forward and said everybody would have to go into rural projects. And we disagree with that. What's your opinion?
I think that there may be fewer urban projects with the tighter TEA rules, at least for the transition period. But I don't subscribe to the fact that urban projects are going to be at a disadvantage. They're still going to have a pretty good reputation in the marketplace in terms of being known. And there are going to be some pretty black and white urban projects that would qualify for high unemployment rate TEAs. It just not may not be as many. Okay. And then I look forward to a time after some transition where the marketplace gets used to the fact that the regular minimum investment amount is the norm in the industry and that TEAs actually are the exception and become an inducement for people to pursue those types of projects, no matter whether they're located in an urban area or in a rural area.
I couldn't agree more on that front. However, I do see that as taking its sweet time in coming in because we have been spoiled at the 500,000 level for so many years. And of course, the at-risk element really does make a difference. This is something that I don't think USCIS really understood when they compared the US program to overseas programs. But getting back to the urban project issue, one of the issues which has come up, and I just want to have your opinion on this, developers have been asking us, what if we have an office in a rural area or in a definite TEA area, which handles all of the paperwork and all of the payroll, and the actual project itself is in a non-TEA area, would that work?
Well, that's an interesting issue, and we often get that question. The USCIS guidance in the policy manual, though, on what constitutes the TEA, the location of a business, is pretty clear. It's where most of the economic activity occurs, whether it's generating revenues for a business, where most the location where most of the employees work for the business, those types of things go into what defines the economic activity tied to a particular geographic area that's used in the TEA calculation. So you couldn't have a situation, for example, where the home office in Seattle does all the payroll and the project, or the home office in rural Montana does the payroll, but the project is located in downtown Seattle in terms of the, for example, the manufacturing facility like a brewery or a coffee bean roasting business. It's where the equipment is located. It's where the location of where the investment is going to be made to support the economic activity in the business and where the employees are actually located that really defines the area that you have to assess for a targeted employment area.
Yeah, that's a very good definition. I think that's a very good starting point for anybody who is thinking of this, because we do have projects where there are split offices, and this issue does come up time and time again. And I know people are going to be looking for sort of loopholes here.
When you pursue loopholes, Mona, in this, it's really a risk management decision for projects.
Yeah.
Documentation can be put together for almost any type of approach that a project wants to take, as long as it's consistent with our overall appetite for the adjudication risk that comes with doing something where you're trying to either push the envelope or get into the gray area of how projects are put together. And I always say to people, anything's possible to put together, but you have to be able to, as part of your overall project and the capital that you put in the project, what's your appetite for risk and how far do you want to test the ability where you might come back with a decision that might be adverse to the development of your project for using EB5 capital?
Completely different area. I know that we have had lots of discussions relating to the different economic models which are going to be utilized post November 21. What about the Redden model? What's the with the whole national impact? Do you see that as changing?
Well, first of all, it's the Redyn model, R-E-D-Y-N, which is the model of choice that we use. There's a whole bunch of different input-output calculators out there that vary in terms of their sophistication and accuracy. And as a professional economist that's been in the business for more than 35 years, we advocate for the tool which produces the most accurate results. Okay, and so that's why we use an input-output tool called Redyn, which is a lot like other tools out there that are of the similar structure. They're called computable general equilibrium models. Okay. And that's the new rage in input output analysis. That's where everybody is going. Even Implant is going in that direction. It's where a tool called REMI, Regional Economic Models Incorporated out of Amherst, Massachusetts, been around since the 80s, has been. I hear Oxford Economics and people overseas are moving in the direction of computable general equilibrium models. And the reason that we like the tool that we use is it gives us the most accurate and most geographically comprehensive impact results. And we're able to differentiate, for example, impacts that happen because of a project right down to the county where the project is located. We can also look at the geography of the regional center, which is usually one of the reporting requirements that the USCIS wants to see. And then we can also isolate and differentiate the projects that happens for a project outside of the geographic boundaries of a regional center, because a lot of the regional centers don't comprise enough geography to capture all the supply chain of a project. For example, a project in downtown Miami, which would be built, there's no steel fabrication facilities in Miami. There's no lumber mills in Miami. There's no place where they build windows or we put together windows, smelt steel, or things like that. And so we use the Redyn model because a project located in downtown Miami or downtown Los Angeles or downtown Seattle or downtown Chicago has the ability, because they are stimulating demand to make lumber and steel and concrete and those kinds of things. And we want to be able to capture those impacts that are associated with the development and construction and operations of those projects. And so that's why we like to use a tool that allows us to report the job impacts all the way along. So when you sum them up, it sums to the total impact of the project among those different geographic regions and lay them out clearly for a USCIS case officer so he or she can really understand what the true impact of these projects is measured most accurately. And that's why we do it.
Well, that makes a lot of sense. And I have to say that we've always preferred using the Redyn or the Redyn model. But then I still say tomato.
Well, Mona, you say tomato. I say the Economic and Policy Resources with Jeff Carr. You can find his website over at eb5economics.com. And Jeff, I'd like to thank you for coming on EB5 Investment Voice and talking about the changes to the Targeted Employment Area program. Now, I've told our listeners before, if they want to learn more about the historical perspective of the TEA program, check out episode 7. But if you also want to know the economic impact of the target employment areas and why they're so valuable to regional centers, I invite you to check out episode 75. And now, as we wrap up, I want to congratulate you, Jeff Carr, on being our first guest to be on EB5 Investment Voice for 3 separate interviews.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you for being with us today on EB5 Investment Voice. The topics presented in this podcast is informational in nature and is not to be taken as specific legal advice. If you have questions on the topics presented in this episode or other investment immigration needs, please contact Mona Shaw and Associates. Mona and her attorney staff can be reached at mshawlaw.com. That's mshahlaw.com. Make sure you don't miss our next episode focusing on a different aspect of the EB-5 program by subscribing to the podcast. While you're at it, leave us a rating on iTunes. If you really found this episode valuable, share it with someone else that could benefit from this information. Until then, I'll see you on the next episode of EB-5 Investment Voice.